busy midweek Wednesday show on April the 15th here on Connecticut Today, keeping you updated on the coronavirus, the implications for business and unemployment. We talked about that in the 1 o'clock hour with the Dean of the Business School at the University of New Haven. Chris Powell joined us from the Manchester Journal-Inquirer to talk about his latest two columns on the virus situation in the state. Speaking of the state, we checked in with Governor Ned Lamont for his daily coronavirus briefing, and a local physician who's also a columnist weighed in on the coronavirus from his point of view as a local practitioner. We keep tabs with the area experts as to what is going on to and through this coronavirus update, and we're talking about the economy. That seems to be the shifting focus now, although we're still watching the number of people who were killed by this virus, the new hospitalizations and all that, but now the plan is what do we roll out in the economy again, both on a local or state level or even a national level? Joining us right now, the Dean of the College of Business at the University of New Haven, Dr. Brian Kench, is on the line. Dr. Kench, Paul here at WICC. Thanks for calling in. How are you today? You doing okay?
I'm doing well. I am doing well. Thank you for asking.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it. Well, you're looking at this from an economic and a business point of view here. What are your overall thoughts on this as this thing seems to be morphing from one week to the other? What are your thoughts on that?
I think the impact on small business was the first wave, and that's been quite significant. I think you see that in some of the weekly unemployment claims. I think last Friday, the report was 302,000 claims that had been filed since the beginning of the crisis. You know, giving some perspective, in the month of February, there were 75,000 folks that were unemployed, and just the magnitude of the change is stunning. And so, you know, the open question as small business goes first, and then some of the larger businesses are dealing with the consequences, you're going to probably see more furloughs that will happen over the period of time where people can perhaps keep their health insurance, but move over and receive unemployment claims plus the additional $600 of weekly compensation, and that goes through July 31. But what the difficult part in forecasting any of this is, as you well know, I'm sure you and your guests have talked about it for weeks now, is the end, right? It's uncertain. And so when you talk about national gross domestic product, just a measure of economic activity, you know, dropping 25-30% in a quarter. I mean, these are just stunning numbers, and so the uncertainty around it is quite troubling.
Yeah, and Dr. Kench, obviously, these big businesses between, you know, loans with the material they can put up for collateral and reopening and getting people out, most of the big businesses will be okay. There are some that may fade away. We'll talk about that in a moment, but you're right. The small businesses, some of whom, you know, restaurants, these small cafes, as you well know, their profit margins, even in good times, aren't great. And who knows what kind of liquidity they may have to assist in whatever assistance they're getting from the state or the feds.
That's right. And so in addition to the, you know, thin margins for the smaller business, you know, their fundamental problem is revenue, right? And so you can take a loan out, sure, but if revenue, you know, stops for 4 weeks or 8 weeks or 12 weeks at some point, it doesn't matter how liquid you might be, you can't go. And so the longer the duration of the downturn and the closure, the more impact that the what people envision as small business impact will be. But, you know, Connecticut has a rich history from its founding in manufacturing, light manufacturing. And so these aren't the big organizations that people have in mind around the country when they think large organizations. But you're talking, you know, somewhere between 100 to 300 employees are in manufacturing companies around the state of Connecticut. You can, you know, just drive down one of these winding roads and you're going to bump into one of them. That's the heart of the state. And those folks are going to be struggling too. So I think, you know, depending on your debt position, if you clearly got more debt, you're in trouble sooner. But even if you don't have a lot of debt, just your stopping of revenue is a major challenge for those companies.
Dr. Brian Kench is Dean of the College of Business at the University of New Haven. Dr. Kench, for lack of a better term here, maybe I'm wrong with this, but you know, to prevent to staunch the bleeding, as they would say, isn't this just going to take enough of the state and even the federal government to just, for lack of a better term, just keep giving out money for a while? I mean, is that what we're looking at to just do this until we're past a danger point here? Because with all this money the Fed is giving out, I mean, obviously they're going to look for some of it back in tax revenue, but is this not just printing money to a point?
So a couple different responses. One, when you see an immediate shock like this, yes, throwing money out into the economy through a targeted means like $600 per individual that has been hit by this to help cover them, fill the gap between the period in which they're in the crisis and when we come out, is exactly the right thing to do. And I think that's why you see a completely and otherwise dysfunctional Congress acting in a matter of moments to sort of send that money out, because that's the right thing to do. There are many other policies that were created that are really loan-based. And just as an example, if you go back and remember 2008 when Lehman Brothers in the fall of 2008 collapsed, and then over a series of 6 or 8 weeks it took Congress to create a $700 billion TARP fund, which was to buy some of these junk assets that, mm-hmm. that companies had. And so in that time, you hear the same logic, right? The government is just printing money. But those were really, they were buying the assets, and at the end of that policy, they were able to sell those assets back off when the economy rebounded, and the government made money on those. So on some of the loan programs, the idea is to create the loan, zero interest in some cases, 1% in others, mm-hmm. get people through the short period, and then if the companies and businesses snap back and reopen, those over time can be paid back. And so, therefore, that's the right thing to do. As I said earlier, though, the big question mark is duration. That works for a short period of time. If the crisis goes on into the fall, right, or longer, it doesn't work in that case. So I think that's the incentive behind many folks for creating some of the policies that they did.
And the guest for a few more minutes, Dr. Brian Kench. He is Dean of the College of Business at the University of New Haven. Dr. Kench, you've probably seen some of the things that we've all started to read over the past few days. Okay, we're going to get the economy up and rolling in these waves, maybe by July and August, with some restrictions we'll have, you know, some matter of normalcy. It'll be the new normal. But I'm reading things long range here. There are some people, particularly a Harvard study that came out on these well-known medical people, Dr. Kench, are saying, hey, wait a minute, this is not going to be anywhere near normal until, you know, early next year, mid-next year. There was a Harvard study that came out yesterday that said, try 2022 for normalcy. Can businesses survive this or not?
Well, not a great answer, but it depends. Mm-hmm. As I said, the uncertainty is real. You don't know what you don't know. But I think every business that has the ability to do so now is, you know, planning for a variety of possible outcomes. I know universities around the country are dealing with this as well. Our revenue source comes from students joining the university each fall. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if there's another, you know, uptick in the fall, does that happen? Or do you go back online? I think there's MIT and Harvard. There's a Boston Globe report saying that they're, you know, at least game planning that maybe they move their fall semester to the spring semester, the spring to the summer. So that's just one industry that's planning. But, you know, there are many industries that are, you know, traditional face-to-face businesses that have to game plan like this. And it's hard to know the unknown, but it is a new strategic risk that exists in the economy that could be, frankly, devastating to many businesses. Now, the flip side of every coin is that there are, you know, other companies that are pivoting very quickly to meet the demands that have been created because of COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And so you see some, you know, biotech and other health-related organizations that are pivoting to meet the need. So there's a churn in this type of environment, but I think the word normal can just be thrown out of the lexicon. The because there is no snapping back to normal, I don't think.
Yeah, and there are some businesses and industries, Dr. Kench, obviously, you look at things like, well, the travel business, the airlines, the cruise line business. I mean, you know, cruises are going to have a heck of a time coming back here. What are your thoughts on the airline industry? I know there's been a debate here. Well, do you give them just cash or a combination of cash and loans, because they do have things like terminal buildings and stock and airplanes they could put up for collateral? What are your thoughts on the perils of the airline industry?
Yes, it's a good question. I haven't thought a lot about it. I think there are clearly loans that are available to them, but what you're facing, frankly, is a behavioral challenge that causes the unknown. What is the consumer going to do? Are they going to get on a plane or a cruise ship or, you know, whatever in terms of the leisure business? Mm-hmm. That's a big portion of the business. And then from the business side, you know, which, you know, for airlines in particular, business class fares and first class fares are a big source of revenue. The new technology that has been, frankly, adopted by force, whether it be Zoom or Skype or, you know, Google,
yes,
is showing to businesses that this is actually a pretty useful way of doing business, and perhaps that travel that once existed might not come back. And so it doesn't matter how many loans that you give, if the business is fundamentally changing. So it's not exactly the answer to the question you asked, but there's a lot of uncertainty. So therefore, it's difficult to create policy and environment when you don't know what the actual target is.
Yeah, and finally, Dr. Kench, dovetailing off of what you just said, I've been saying here for weeks that I think one thing that's going to happen here, a byproduct of this, is I think businesses are going to take a hard look, really, because of this experience and judging how well they did or did not do under these work-at-home situations. I'm doing this show right now from a section of my condo here. I think a lot of businesses, Dr. Kench, are going to look at their plans and say, well, wait a minute, we kind of got most of our stuff done with all of our people working at home, or a good many of them. So I can see this maybe affecting long term the commercial real estate market, or businesses saying, hey, you know, do we need all this square footage? Can we save money this way? It could be a real game changer, I think.
Absolutely. It is working. You've got large organizations that, you know, turned on a dime and have kept their businesses going, and the customer service has been unchanged. And from the workforce perspective, there are some individuals that have a preference for working at home for, you know, work-life flexibility, whether they've got children. It does reduce the square footage costs of businesses that if they want to sort of downsize their, you know, footprint at a central location, increase the quality of life for their workforce. Frankly, that reduces the waste that one has to pay them. All of these things are back on the table. Even migration into cities, which was a large phenomenon over the last 15 years or so since 2000. Some people are concerned about living in very densely populated areas now, and so you might see a reverse migration back to these leafy suburbs that have just struggled, particularly in Connecticut, where, you know, home values haven't changed too much because the demand for them decreased. That could change as well, but, you know, these are all hypotheses, right? And you know, time will tell.
Dr. Brian Kench, Ph.D., Dean of the College of Business at the University of New Haven. Dr. Kench, thanks so much. We appreciate the time. Be good, stay safe, and we'll talk in the future. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye.
Thanks, Dr. Brian Kench there. Joining us again, as he is wanting to do every so often when he lets loose with his columns, which I believe at twice a week basis or even more, it's Chris Powell, a editorialist, former managing editor of the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Chris, how are you? How is your social distancing going these days?
Well, I'm not on a ventilator, Paul, so I'm one of the lucky ones.
Okay, thank you. And that's serious. Yeah. You know, Chris, couple of columns you came out with this week. We'll talk about your one that comes out tomorrow in a moment. But your Tuesday column posted, and as you always do, an interesting question. How will the governor answer demands for freedom? And Chris, as I've been talking about the last hour and change or so, and obviously you've heard from programs like this, people know the risks involved here. We're no way out of the woods, but the people of Connecticut, like all over the world and the country, you know, they're getting a little antsy here, Chris. So they, you know, the screws are really being turned up on a guy who I think has done a good job in this, but Governor Lamont's got to take all this into account when he makes some decisions here.
Yeah, well, he is acknowledging that, you know, they're thinking about this and they want to get at it. They don't have any real plan yet, and I can't blame him for not having one. He's doing all he can just to keep the hospitals and nursing homes in good order. But there's things we could do, I think, Paul. You know, we're not all shut down. You know, the supermarkets can open. The military contractors can stay in business, and the food processors can stay in business. You know, even those places that are staying in business are reporting, you know, certain number of infections that apparently are considered acceptable to keep the country defended and keep the country fed. So I think you have to wonder whether we could reopen safely certain businesses where, say, people were maintaining social distance, where there wasn't a lot of, you know, packing as there is in restaurants and bars. If people were required to wear masks, if they were required to have their temperatures taken before they came in, I suspect that a bunch of businesses could be permitted to reopen on those terms. I don't see how you could do too much with the schools and the bars and the restaurants, because there's, I think it's just impossible to enforce social distancing there. But I think you can look at the places that were allowing to stay open now and wonder why certain other businesses could not be permitted to reopen following those rules.
Yeah, Chris, and one thing that we're seeing really from both sides of the aisle, in fact, I don't know whether you heard, there was a Indiana congressman yesterday on a major station in Indianapolis. It's starting to make the rounds today in the news cycle. During an interview, he said, listen, and the term he said was, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he said, you know, we have to put on our big boy and big girl pants and do what we have to do here, fully realizing that more people will get sick and likely die. And on the other side of this, Chris, there was a really good piece, I don't know whether you saw it in the New York Times earlier this week, with a bunch of medical ethicists, many of them left-leaning, say, well, yeah, that's going to happen if you, you know, if you do reopen. It's not an easy question to confront or to try and answer.
No, it's not. And I think what those other people are noting is that people are going to die if we don't reopen. There's, you know, not only going to be suicides and depression and, you know, lost businesses and lost retirement savings. There's also going to be an immense loss of tax revenue that will not be able to be spent on public health in the future. So, you know, this is a judgment call. It's a balance, and the arguments are not all on one side. In fact, there were a fairly large number of medical experts who objected to the national lockdown when it was imposed. They thought it would be worse than the disease, and they thought that the people who should have been quarantined were the most vulnerable, and that precautions short of, you know, this massive lockdown and impairment to the economy were not necessary. Now, those people were not necessarily conservative or liberal. They were medical people, and some of them even got published in the New York Times. And I think as the economic circumstances of the population worsen over the next few weeks, because so many people are out of work, I think those people are going to be considered to have been right.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, and we're talking, by the way, with Chris Powell from the Manchester JI. You know, Chris, I personally know some people in my family, some close relatives, and you know, who now, thankfully, some of that have come back, has come back, and they're not of retirement age yet. But I know at least a couple of people close to me who lost hundreds, Chris, of thousands of dollars in the onset of this. And, you know, I talked to one of them a few days ago. I said, how are you doing? And this person said, well, I'm about a third to a halfway back. But, heck, maybe I shouldn't retire anyway. But honestly, you're right. I mean, I think, Chris, people have a tendency to only look at this from the epidemiological standpoint, which is granted, I get that. People die of this stuff. But you're right. And when President Trump came out a few weeks ago and said, you know, the cure can be worse than the disease, you know, the usual suspects climbed on top of him. But I think a lot of people said, well, I don't love the guy, but he's right.
Yeah, well, there were people who had nothing to do with Trump and no political interest who feared and said that this might be worse than the disease. Governor Cuomo said something the other day that I thought was very demagogic and misleading along these lines. He said that, you know, we can't choose between lives on one hand and money on the other. And that is so wrong, because that's what government does every day. You know, government is to choose, as I think John Kennedy said. If you spend money on public health, you don't spend it on something else. If you spend it on something else, you don't spend it on public health. We're spending, even today, trillions of dollars a year in the stupid occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. That mm-hmm. money is not available for public health. The Yankee Institute pointed out today that starting July 1, the state of Connecticut is going to start paying another $353 million annually and raises the state employees. That money will not largely be spent on public health either. You know, to govern is to choose. And every time we put a budget together in government, we are choosing between money on one hand and public health on the other.
And Chris, finally, in your first column, before we take a break here, you do bring up something interesting regarding, in fact, it's something that callers have brought up here too, Chris, regarding the order forbidding evictions and how that ties into private property rights here, even in this time of a medical emergency.
Yeah, the governor finally got around to doing something for the renters the other day. And look, I'm not faulting him. I don't know how he can keep his head on straight. I think he's done a magnificent job altogether. But the other day, under his emergency powers, he issued an order that there can't be any evictions of renters for a few months, and that's you know, fine. The problem is that this could be construed as a taking of the landlord's property, and I think it probably would be construed as a taking of property, and the emergency regulations that authorize the governor to take property do require that compensation be ascertained and paid when the emergency is over. Look, that's fine with me. I think we got to do our damnedest to make everybody safe and, you know, intact in their homes. But when this is over, instead of paying, you know, $353 million in raises, we may be settling up all sorts of reimbursements that we owe people because of the emergency orders that the governor imposed.
A few more minutes with a gentleman we check in with about once a month, every so often, Chris Powell, columnist for the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. A column came out yesterday, another one coming out tomorrow, the 16th, regarding the current Connecticut situation with coronavirus. And Chris, in your column tomorrow, you've also echoed something that I don't think people take into account as much. You know, we've heard warnings about these possible pandemics for years. You know, you get people that go up and they get a congressional hearing where they can speak and they say, well, you know, Professor so-and-so, what would you say we do? Well, the first thing we need to do is get, you know, 1 billion pieces of personal protective equipment, goggles and face shields and masks and smocks and gloves and all this. And then the invariable question is, Chris, well, how do we pay for that? And you say that it's always comes down to a choice of dollars versus business and lives. And no matter how many warnings we get about this, we often take the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, well, you know, we're lucky. We live in this country which issues the world reserve currency. So whenever we're short of money, we can just issue some more bonds, and the foreigners likely will buy mm-hmm. it because they need dollars to get into international trade. We don't have to choose as much as, you know, people in other countries do. But to govern is to choose, And if you want to be ready for the next epidemic, well, we'll presumably learn some lessons from this one. The inventories of the ventilators and the masks and the gowns, you know, were not sufficient to a nationwide epidemic. And well, maybe we'll have to divert some resources to that. But you know, we're fortunate in this country insofar as we do, Paul, spend so much money on inessential things.
Yeah.
I mean, it turns out apparently we were helping to finance the studies of bat viruses at that bioweapons lab in Wuhan because you know, it was virus research, and maybe it was just virus research, and maybe it was a bioweapon research. But why are we financing Chinese medical research? I mean, it's just there's so much we spend money on that if you look at it and said, hey, is this really essential to, you know, the maintenance of decent society in the United States? No, you would say no. But, you know, we don't have enough masks. We don't have enough gowns. We don't have enough ventilators. We don't have enough antibiotics, which are all made in China now. You know, this is going to be something we have to address when this is over. I hope we do things very differently.
If you and I are talking a year from now, Chris, about this, which I hope we will be, what do you think for Connecticut? What does Connecticut look like, say, 12 months down the line in the spring of 2021?
Well, probably financially, state government will be much poorer than it is today. This is going to be an invitation to state government to check some of its premises as to how it spends its money. You know, the estimate is that state government is going to lose at least $1.5 billion in tax revenue, quite apart from what we get reimbursed from the federal government for our epidemic expenses. Now, $1.5 billion is about 15% of the state budget. How are we going to economize with state government and municipal government, because municipal government is financed largely by state government? How are we going to economize, say, to the degree of 15%? We ought to start thinking about that now. Businesses that we had before the virus are not going to come back. Some of them will, but, you know, a lot of the restaurants are probably going to be wiped out. And I'm, you know, especially sorry to say a lot of the news organizations are likely to be wiped out. They were already struggling before the epidemic, and now advertising has gone down to, you know, practically nothing. The economic impact on Connecticut is going to be severe, and that is going to require state government to economize severely.
And, you know, in the political process of this, Chris, they're going to have to look for the money. And where do they look for the money when they need it, right? You and I both know that.
Well, I think raising taxes has gone as far as it can go. About 50% of state government's money goes for government employees' compensation on the state and municipal level. And I don't see how the state can survive unless we start economizing there.
Chris Powell, thank you. We appreciate it, and we will be in touch. Take care of yourself, and we'll talk down the line. Thank you, Chris. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Let me just quickly run over some of the numbers for you, if you have that. Max? You'll see in terms of positive cases, the trend is sort of continuous. You see the tests themselves go up and down depending on a variety of variables. It's just incredible to me that there's a national shortage of swabs. Swabs are like Q-tips. How can this country not have enough swabs so we can accelerate the testing, which is so key to getting people back to work? But anyway, those are interesting numbers. I think you're probably noticing laboratory-confirmed deaths. That's a big number, 197. What the hell is going on? In terms of the deaths that are reported out of the hospitals that we know, that number is consistent with what we're used to. We did have a catch-up here with about 170 folks, our citizens, who sadly passed away. Often there's a catch-up because we don't know. They die at home. They don't die at a hospital. We don't know what exactly is related to the death. So those are catch-up numbers. But I think you should just take a look there and know that that death number does take us up to 868. The currently hospitalized, 129, we saw a downward trend that's leaking up a little bit. Let's go to the next slide. We can talk about that a bit. This is a trend that's sort of similar to what you've seen before. Fairfield, you see, was flattening out Fairfield County a week ago, and today you see it ramping up a little bit. And I described recently that was a bit due to the flare-up in Bridgeport. Next, you see that New Haven was flattening out, ramping up a little bit as well. And finally, Hartford County. Next slide, please. This slide is really important because I always give you the net numbers. I always show you, this is the net increase in the number of people who are in ICU beds. And that's really important because that tells you about our capacity in our different hospitals. But it doesn't necessarily tell you the trend on infections. And that's registered by hospital admissions. The net numbers, admissions versus discharges. We have a lot of people being discharged. But in case anybody's getting complacent, you'll see the number of admissions in Fairfield County is going up as fast as it ever has. You'll see perhaps that while New Haven is leveling off a little bit in terms of that slant, Hartford is going up. So these are numbers that we track all the time, we think is a leading indicator in terms of what's going on. But basically, I think you see the numbers are still choppy. So there's been a little bit of hope out there that we weren't going up geometrically or exponentially like we used to say. There's still a lot of admissions in hospitals. That means that reflects infection rate, and that reflects the fact we still have some work to do. What's the next slide there? And that's it by counties. Let me just say a couple of things. One, this is April 15th. This used to be known as Tax Day, not this year. This year our tax day is July 15th because we've been able to push that off as the federal government has also pushed that off to give everybody a little bit more breathing room in terms of managing their cash flow. And Tax Day always used to lead to tax protests. Well, today is not Tax Day, but there are still a number of stay-at-home protests around the country. And I was just on the phone with all my fellow governors, just giving a heads up on what's going on. Out of Michigan, I was sort of interested to hear that in Lansing, Michigan, there's Operation Gridlock, and cars are honking their horns in front of the state capitol saying, let's go, let's open up. It was reflected by the fact that the governor there put a cap on not being able to buy gardening and home improvement things, something we haven't done in this state, by the way. You can still do that. It gives you an idea of how antsy people are in terms of the stay-at-home order. One of the signs I thought was a little amusing, I don't mean to make light, but Michigan recently legalized marijuana, and they've outlawed gardening equipment. So the sign said, we can smoke grass, but we can't cut the grass. It's the opposite here in this state, by the way. I noticed that we've had some petitions, for example, from salon operators here on this state saying, May 1, let's go, open up, it's time to open up. And that nobody wants to get opened more than we do. And we're going to spend a lot of time today and then, importantly, tomorrow when we announce the advisory board in terms of steps we are taking to get our state opened up. I know how important opening up is to our small businesses. I know the collapse in revenue. I know the fact that we've got, in part, a lot of supports in place from the Paycheck Protection and our own loan program, but that's not good enough. People are ready to open up. I was on the phone today with the Black and Puerto Rican Caucus, and I was just reminded them that it's easy for me to stay at home. You've given me a really nice home. I can spend a week and not see Annie in the governor's residence. But there are a lot of folks who are multi-generational, living in really contained spaces in small apartments. They don't have a backyard, and stay at home is really tough. And I've got to ask people to tough it out a little bit longer. And I'm trying my best to make it easier for you. A lot of my fellow states are, shutting down parks and shutting down beaches. And I don't think that helps. All that does is squeeze people into more crowded outdoor spaces elsewhere. People still need to be able to take a walk at a safe distance. And Katie Dykes, our commissioner, it's her birthday today, by the way. Katie Dykes has been tough about limiting the number of cars at beaches and at parks. And I hope that's good enough. I'm on the phone in an hour with all of our mayors and first selectmen. And I'm going to encourage them to go maybe even the opposite direction. Instead of closing down parks, maybe close down some of the roads to automobile traffic so people have more room, not just on sidewalks, but can walk and enjoy themselves outside as the weather gets nicer in a boulevard. You know, that said, working closely with others and looking at best practices around the country, I think it's time for us to also be really strict about the need to wear masks. Even masks you make yourself, just the bandanas or the scarf or the surgical mask, not the N95 masks. You know, they are reserved for our frontline healthcare workers. And, I wear this sort of, it's not a fashion statement, but if you're walking around and you need a little bit of space, you're going up to a group of people there, just put on your mask. If you're walking around in the park and there's a crowd, put on a mask. If they're crowded together, tell them they should keep their social distance, but you be careful as well. We're going to be very clear with our employers that if you're in a public space there, your grocery store and the such, retail, you've got to make sure that your employees are wearing masks. And anybody coming into that particular facility, starting with grocery stores, have to wear a mask. I think this is the way that we're going to get this virus behind us sooner and make sure that we can get everybody back to work as soon as we possibly can. So social distancing is key to that. We're getting the masks as fast as we can at the state level, but right now it's an employer's job and employees to make sure you're wearing that in any place where you have public interface with people. You know, as I mentioned before, we're going to be ramping up the testing. You saw we had a lot of tests today, but that's conditioned upon the swabs. But remember, social distancing and testing and the therapies we're working on that keep people out of the hospital, at least out of the ICU, cut the amount of time they're there, are all a bridge to getting the vaccine. And that's how we eventually get behind this. That vaccine could be 6-12 months away. So we've got to be extraordinarily careful in terms of everything you do between now and then to make sure we get this pandemic under control and to make sure we have a bridge to a vaccine that makes sure then we can get back to our life in the new normal as best we can. And I'll talk a little bit about the federal next supplemental that's coming out, but just remember, they've done $2.4 trillion. And Governor Baker from Massachusetts reminded us today that almost none of that is going to public health. Almost none of that is going to development of the new therapies we need or how we reconstitute existing therapies to apply to COVID. Almost none of that's going to vaccinations. We got amazing private companies, so many of them right here in the state of Connecticut, that are working on these therapies, working on these vaccinations. But this should be our Apollo project. This should be a real focus of the federal government. This is how we get back to work and get our economy going in a real way if we put our money where our mouth is when it comes there. The PPP, the Paycheck Protection, some good news, that money is going out. They've already approved about $3 billion in loans for the state of Connecticut. That's to about 12,000 applications have been agreed to right now in the state. There's still money there. You can still go to the DECD or small business websites or 211 will get you the information you need so you can apply. The $1,200 checks are going out the door as we speak. They should be landing or direct deposit. That's $1,200 per person for everybody that files a tax return. And as we've said before, if you didn't file a tax return, you're still eligible, and go to 211 and we can get you the information you need on how to do that. I will tell you that the governors were really focused on this next supplemental coming out of Washington. It's been delayed right now. I think the Republicans are more focused on the PPP, the Paycheck Protection, more money for small business, get that going. It looks like the Democrats are focused on that, but also think we need another supplemental to support the states and the municipalities. I think they're both right, but we desperately do need more flexibility in terms of what we provide for the states and for the municipalities. Right now, the federal government reimburses us for COVID-related expenses, but not for a loss of revenue. And as I've said before, that we're in pretty good shape compared to our peers when it comes to making up for the loss of sales tax revenue and some income tax revenue. Other states are in real duress right now, but we're all going to need some backup here so we can round the bend on July 1st, knowing that our budgets are in pretty good shape. You know, I think with that, I mentioned to you that Andy Mays, our amazing insurance commissioner, is on. And I'm going to steal some of his thunder because that's my prerogative. Sorry, Andy. But I'll give you all credit where credit is due, because this is the guy that has really taken the lead. He worked with our insurance providers, remember, going back a few weeks ago, and we got the two-month grace period. The insurance capital of America, Hartford, Connecticut, helped take the lead in making sure you got a two-month grace period there for property and casualty as well as for health insurance. And that's a bridge to other loans that make sure your health insurance is continuous. He mentioned today, I was so impressed that for our first line responders as well, you know, a lot of them have health insurance that is not as full as it should be, with high deductibles and high copays. And there, all COVID-related expenses are covered, just like they are for Medicaid and Medicare and the such. Those COVID-related expenses for testing as well as for treatments. You know, thank you, Andy, and thank you to the insurance companies for taking the lead there as well. And when it comes to life insurance, he gave us some good news today, which is Connecticut and Massachusetts working together with Mass Mutual. There is a $25,000 in life insurance provided for each and every one of our frontline healthcare responders, anything related to COVID. And that's going to be free for the next 3 years. So, Andy, I'm sorry to steal your thunder, but I really want to thank you for what you've been able to do there. And also on the line is a Kurt Westby, who's going to have some continuing good news as we get those checks out, over $100 million, I think, right now, and unemployment has gone out the door and a fast catch-up. I think with that, let me just take a break and see what questions. What, Andy, why don't you just say a little bit more about what we've done on the insurance, thanks to your leadership.
Well, thank you, Governor, and thank you for your leadership here. It wouldn't have been possible without you. What we've done, we've made a number of changes, as you mentioned, to make it easier for people who are facing concerns because of COVID-19. But if I can just take some time to put in a commercial here for our Access Health program. That is our health exchange, the Obamacare, Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it. But that is the exchange where people can go to get insurance. And what we've done, and again, this was done with the cooperation of the health insurance companies, is we created a special enrollment period. We've got two more days left in that. So it goes till April 17th. If, for instance, you're a member of the gig economy, you had chosen back during the regular enrollment period to not get health insurance, I would strongly suggest you go to the Access Health site. But most people who get COVID-19 will be fine, but if you're not, the cost can be tremendous. So I would think this would be a great opportunity to go get health insurance on the Access Health site. Again, it runs, the open and the special enrollment period runs until April 17th. And as the governor mentioned earlier, part of the good news that we've had, and this came out of our discussions with our health insurers, with the health insurance carriers in Connecticut, they have agreed they will cover from the first dollar everything to do with COVID-19 treatment. So that means testing, there will be no deductible, there will be no copay. If, unfortunately, you need to get treatment, there will be no deductible, there will be no copay. And as the governor said, and I have to give the governor credit, because the governor had raised this concern last week, I think it was. We do have people who went out and they wanted health insurance. They got the best insurance they could afford, but that might have been a high deductible plan. And we did not want them to have to be concerned about their finances if something happened. So all kudos to the health insurance industry. They've stepped up here. We've also seen, of course, the life and auto insurance industry, well, the property casualty insurance industry. They've done a number of things, including, along with the health insurers, we've got that 60-day grace period. I'm sure you've seen in the news that a number of the auto insurers, and there's more being announced every day, it's simply a matter of getting the systems up, are going and they're providing rebates. Actually, I shouldn't call it rebates, but they're giving money back to consumers over these 2 months because of the reduction in the amount of driving. So if you're out on the road, you know that not that many people are driving. It's certainly lower than normal. So the risk that the insurance companies are bearing will be less. Now they're giving you back some of that money. If you call your insurance company and if you have a concern, always feel free to reach out to the insurance department. Probably the easiest way to do it these days is to reach out to insurance@ct.gov. And another example of how the insurance companies have stepped up here, I do have to mention, as the governor said this morning, I was very pleased recently when I got a call from the people at MassMutual, the leadership at MassMutual. They have a foundation that's headquartered in Enfield, Connecticut, and they've got a program that we've worked with them on called LifeBridge that offers life insurance for people of certain income levels. So if anything happens to a parent, then the child would be able to get an education. And they said, we're thinking, what do you think would help if we did this in this current environment? Would it help or the people who are on the front lines, the people who are exposed to COVID-19, if we were to offer them some life insurance? And I said, you get me a proposal and we will turn it around, give it the approval as fast as we can. And my team, I have to give the full credit to my team, Paul Lombardo, and the people at the Connecticut Insurance Department got that done so incredibly fast. Actually, just before I got here, I got a call from the general counsel at MassMutual saying that was a wonderful job. And I think it's just wonderful. They're offering up to $25,000 in free life insurance for 3 years. There is an income test. You have to make less than $250,000 or $260,000 a year, which means if I were on the front lines, I'd be able to make it. But it would be for anyone on the front lines, as long as you're working for a licensed hospital, licensed EMS, or for one of the urgent care centers. If you're between 18 and 50, you get the full $25,000. Between 51 and 60, you get $10,000. And it doesn't matter. There is absolutely no cost to you. And it lasts for 3 years, absolutely free. If you go to our insurance department website at ct.gov/CID, you'll see the information. I'm sure MassMutual will also have that information on their website. And it's easy. It's going to be done online. What you do is you're going to scan in your badge or whatever that shows that you worked someplace. You just answer a few questions. And it's not just, this is important too, it's not just for the doctors and nurses. It's for the other people in the hospital that may be exposed. We're talking the security people that will be the first people to meet people coming into the hospital. We're talking the custodial staff that may have to clean up and are exposed to the COVID-19 virus. This is there for you. And there are, as the governor mentioned, there are a number of other items that we're doing and that we're still working on. But my one request for you, we're all in this together, and at the insurance department, it's important for us to know if you have any concerns and to be able to help you. So if you have any concerns, please reach out to us at insurance@ct.gov. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Any questions, Max?
We'll go first to the Hartford Current.
Hi, sorry for the delay. This is Rebecca Lurie. Can you tell us more, or maybe clarify your recommendations on wearing masks? New Haven Mayor Justin Eliker just announced that people have to wear them in stores there. New York is requiring masks when you're out in public. Are you making a recommendation or a mandate here?
I am strongly saying this is what you got to do, and it'll probably be reflected in an executive order within 48 hours. And that is, look, if you can keep your social distance, you don't have to wear a mask. If Paul gets a little closer to me, we're going to both be wearing a mask. If you're walking down the block and you're by yourself, that's fine. If you get to a crowded group, wear a mask. If you go into a store, you're going to be interfacing with somebody at the store, wear a mask. If you work at that store, you work at the grocery store, wear a mask. And if you can't, if your employer doesn't get you the mask, get yourself a scarf or something comparable. I think this is the way that we can get this virus, stop it dead in its tracks, and help this state get moving again.
Our next guest, a return guest here to the program, we've had him on a few times before. Interesting gentleman. He's a practicing physician, ophthalmologist, living in Connecticut from Fairfield. Numerous op-ed pieces you'll see that he's written for the Hartford Courant and the New York Times. He's got his own website. He posted a rather interesting piece that I wanted to talk with him about because I'm hearing that from more and more physicians. Dr. Joe Benevenia joins us. Joe, how are you today? Everything good?
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Paul.
Good. I'm glad you can help out here.
Well, you're not doing much else.
Well, yeah, you know, let me ask you, Joe is a practicing physician. What's your patient load been like during this whole thing? And I'm wondering about that. I'm not set to see my doctor for another month and a half, but how are you folks doing? Are you still seeing patients or what?
Well, I'm an ophthalmologist, and my particular profession doesn't have that many emergencies. So I'm seeing patients only on an emergent basis. So if you're having, like, you know, a piece of metal in your eye or you lose your vision suddenly, then, of course, we're taking care of you. But if it's, you know, I lost my glasses or some issue like that, maybe it's not taken care of quite as quickly as you would like.
No, use that spare set of glasses that everybody's supposed to have, right?
Yeah.
The piece you put up here, more coronavirus testing helpful but not a panacea. Joe, you're saying this. I've even heard Anthony Fauci say this. I've talked to infectious disease people who've said this. They say that don't get wrapped up too much in this testing whole aspect of it, correct?
Well, the whole thing is, like, one of the rules we have, we doctors have, is if you order a test, you have to know what to do with the result of it. And what's going on here is they're talking about testing everyone, but you're not quite sure what to do with the result. And the reason is these tests were developed very quickly. And I'm not berating the companies that have done it, but they have a lot of what are called false positives and false negatives. A false positive is when the test is positive and you don't have the coronavirus. And we're finding with the false negatives, where the test is negative and you do have the coronavirus, it's like 25 to 30%. So what they're saying is, oh, we have to test everybody, but these results are not going to be particularly accurate as far as planning public policy. And In the article I divided it up into two tests. One test, the one I just alluded to, was tests for the actual virus. The other one tests for the antibodies to the virus. And again, these patients have different responses. So you might make the antibodies to the virus, but maybe if you're older or you have a debilitating condition, it might not be strong enough to fight off an infection. It's also possible to make antibodies to the infection and still be positive for the disease. Of course, that would be late in the course of the disease and when you were making the antibodies. But the point is, you know, what they're saying is, oh, we're going to get this whole group of people who are immune to the disease and let them back out in the community. And it just might not be that accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So it just amazes me how many people think, like, you know, we doctors have the answers to things. And quite frankly, we don't.
Yeah,
this is a very complex situation that can't be predicted by anybody.
Connecticut physician and blogger and author Dr. Joe Benevenia joins us for a few more minutes. His latest piece at Joseph Benevenia at his website, Joe Benevenia, JoeBenevenga.com. More coronavirus testing helpful, but not a panacea. Joe, what happened back in 1347, and why should we pay any attention to something that happened in 1347?
Well, what's fascinating is when I wrote that article, I did a lot of research on previous epidemics that happened. And in Europe, you have to understand there were two major epidemics that would happen. One was the bubonic plague, and the other was malaria. And back then, nobody understood what the germ theory was. They didn't even know why people got these diseases, but they did figure out it was contagious. Matter of fact, the word malaria is Italian for mal, which means bad. Area is air. Huh. In other words, malaria means bad air. Mm-hmm. So the Italians figured out there was something to do with the air. They didn't figure it out it was the mosquito, but they figured it out was the air. And then they figured out what the solution was. The solution was to quarantine people. And that's exactly what we're doing today. But the fascinating thing is, where did the word quarantine come from? It comes from the Italian word quaranta, which means 40. So they said the time to quarantine people was 40 days. And they would do this when a ship came in with tuberculosis or typhus or malaria. If the sailor or smallpox, if the sailors were sick, they would make that ship sit there for 40 days. And they would do it with the bubonic plague, and they would do it with malaria. And what I found so fascinating about it was basically our politicians are coming up with the same number. Even though we have all these epidemiologists and all these experts, it's still the same number. I mean, basically, President Trump said at the end of March, we're going to try to end this by May 1st. Now, whether he does that or not, I don't know. But it's about 40 days. And 40 days is about, if you really think about it, it's about amount of time that your typical epidemic will peak, or it's the amount of time your population will tolerate being told they can't make a living.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing both of those numbers becoming operative here. We're seeing the epidemic peaking at about 30 to 40 days, but we're also seeing the average person saying, like, you know, I have to pay rent, you know, I have to take care of my family, and like, you're telling me I have to stay inside, and we're just getting tired of this.
You know, so, Joe, you wonder, and this is where my mind goes on these things. You wonder if that 40 days thing had any biblical reference to it. You know, the 40 days and 40 nights thing. I mean, who knows?
Well, the articles did allude to the biblical reference, but I think the more likely thing was your politicians of the day in Venice or Paris who were figuring these out and trying to figure out what to do were probably like talking to people who were burying the bodies and talking to their, you know, people who were, you know, sequestered or quarantined.
Yeah.
And they probably the people who were burying the body said, yeah, well, we're not burying as many now. And so they said, oh, well, the epidemic's ending. And you have to understand, Paul, the bubonic plague wiped out a third of Europe, like the
Amazing.
One in 1347.
Oh.
A third of the people died. It was like a ridiculous, huge amount of people. And so I think your politicians sort of were able to figure out the epidemiology just the way our politicians are figuring it out today by talking. You know, they would talk to the doctors back then or the people doing the burials, whereas basically our politicians are doing the same thing. They're talking to the doctors and they're looking at the number of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
So and they're looking at when the curve's starting to decrease, and then they're trying to relax the standards so people can get back to work.
Joe, in medical school, I understand if somebody becomes a virologist or an epidemiologist or a biologist, but how much of this stuff, Joe, is taught in basic medical school before you decide on your specialty? I've always wondered that during this whole thing.
That's a very good question, and you'd be surprised. Actually, a great deal is taught. At least when now I'm talking 40 years ago. I think the medical schools nowadays are a little more clinical. They get the kids in the clinic earlier than when I was a student. We had much more emphasis on biochemistry and immunology. But mm-hmm. It's funny you should ask that question, because I'll never forget. We had these lectures on immunology, which is, of course, what virology and what, you know, these medications are, trying to, you know, get the immune system working. And it was given to us by this brilliant professor. I even remember his name. It was Dr. Kreider. And he gave us about six or eight lectures, and he was a very funny man. And at the end of the last lecture, he turns around and looks at us, and he says, you understand that half of what I taught you is wrong, but I don't know what half it is. And I don't think much has changed since then. And that's why, you know, I think people are getting frustrated listening to all the experts, because they really don't know.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting? I did read, Joe, and you know, doing this kind of a show, I'm inundated with this stuff for 7 or 8 hours a day. I'm also reading, although they say it's not likely, this does come from the coronavirus family, obviously, which we know about, numerous other variables here. But there are some people saying, hey, wait a minute. I know we should plan for the worst, but, you know, there are some people saying, wait a minute. MERS died out. SARS died out. There are even some people saying this could turn out in a few months to be that. And then obviously that would be the best case scenario, obviously.
Right. But it's impossible to predict. And that's why you'll see Dr. Fauci or Dr. Brix being very vague when you try to pin them down, because nobody really knows. I mean, for all you know, the virus could mutate and come back in a more aggressive fashion. You can't predict that.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that we're in quarantine, you know, you'll read that what they're doing is lowering the peak curve. Well, that means it's going to last longer. In other words, if you did absolutely nothing, you would have had a lot more deaths. The system would have been overwhelmed, but you would have had the herd immunity come quicker.
Yeah.
Now it's going to happen at a slower pace. And it might happen in a more regional area. You might see New York not having issues, but then all of a sudden pockets in rural America starting to have spikes a few months from now. So it's very hard to predict. And that's why, you know, when you ask doctors and even these people who are experts, you're going to get basically a vague answer. The other thing people don't understand is doctors, you know, whether you're a liberal feminist or a conservative like me, we tend to be very cautious people when giving advice. So, you know, we tend to overemphasize the risks and underemphasize the benefits, because when we're dealing with patients, I did a lot of surgery. I would always tell the patient, you know, this could go wrong and that could go wrong. Mm-hmm. And it might take a couple of weeks for this operation to clear up, whereas I did cataract surgery and the vast majority were seeing fine in 2 or 3 days. So your patient's very happy, especially when you warn them. So you're seeing that same phenomena going on here, where the doctors are saying this could go wrong and that can go wrong.
Sure.
And it's just part of human nature, because they don't want to be blamed if they'd say, oh, everything will be fine and everything isn't fine.
Well, yeah.
Because we all know in medicine you can't predict what's going to happen. And the simplest scenario can become an utter disaster.
Exactly, Joe, and exactly, and I'm sure when these doctors are pulled into the Oval Office with the president and the vice president there and whomever, and they say, doctor, you know, what's the worst case scenario? An infectious disease person, no matter what their political slant is going to say, okay, I've got to give them the worst case scenario. You know, 4 million people would die. You can't blame the doctor. You can't blame the doctor.
Right. And I sort of get annoyed, and I see it happening on both sides of the political aisle when they're saying, well, the doctors are like, you know, thinking politically. It was like, well, maybe some of them are, but when I hear them speak, they think just like me. It's like, yeah, they're being very cautious because they don't know. And the last thing you want to do is sit there and say, oh, everything will be fine, and all of a sudden see huge disaster happening.
His website is... Joe, I'm sorry, I've got to scoot here. His website is JoeBentivenia.com, JoeBentivenia.com. Joe, fascinating stuff from a perspective of a doctor, and we appreciate it. Dr. Joe Bentivenia. Joe, thank you. We appreciate the time, as always.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks,
bye-bye.
Joe. Appreciate it.